From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C.
All right, the 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, and they will vote for this president no matter what.
This past week, we heard a lot of discussion about comments made by presidential candidate Mitt Romney at a fundraiser earlier this year. Some commentators immediately pounced on the remarks as proof positive that the GOP nominee is astoundingly dismissive of a vast number of American voters. Others insisted that the governor had merely articulated a sad truth, and that President Obama's controversial description of some voters as clinging to guns and religion and being disinclined to vote for him back in 2008 was equally damning. Well, a timely and comprehensive new survey from the Public Religion Research Institute has just been released, and that offers important insights on these very issues. It's called Beyond God and Guns, Understanding the Complexities of the White Working Class in America. And PRRI founding CEO Dr. Robert P. Jones will be here to discuss the highlights of this polling.
Well, taught in the textbooks of their curriculum that dinosaurs and humans, they probably hung out, coexisted in harmony. Another lesson, dragons were real. We're talking fire-breathing animals that exhale fire and smoke. The Red Scare, it isn't over yet, according to their text. And globalization, that's ultimately leading up to the rapture.
I realize we've addressed the unprecedented dismantling of Louisiana's public education system through Governor Bobby Jindal's broad voucher program several times on this show already. But the fact that this effort, which funnels large amounts of tax dollars to overtly religious schools with little or no oversight, is widely seen as a national model for education reform. The fact that few things a society does are as defining of that society's future as the way it educates the next generation, and the fact that young Louisiana education activist Zach Coplin has committed to fighting this initiative, all are reasons to revisit Jindal's folly once again. Zach joins us later on this week's show. But first,
Senators, I came here today to ask the government to give my mother the dignity of being a statistic.
That's Harpreet Singh Saini, an 18-year-old American Sikh who lost his mother in the tragic massacre at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek in August. Those words were perhaps the most moving moment of a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights hearing this past Wednesday. Interfaith Alliance was honored to be among the organizations asked to submit testimony for that hearing. Shocked and saddened as we all were at the tragedy, it also helped to illuminate longstanding flaws in the way federal law enforcement tracks similar crimes. Simply put, it doesn't work. It doesn't track. And the first few pages of the comprehensive written testimony submitted to the subcommittee by the Sikh Coalition, the largest Sikh civil rights organization in the United States, are enough to demonstrate that the Oak Creek shooting was far from the first compelling reason that it should. Joining me in the studio is my friend Amardeep Singh, the co-founder and director of programs for the Sikh Coalition. Amardeep, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's a fundamental principle that before you can solve a problem, you have to be able to identify the problem. Why has it been so difficult to get federal authorities to simply compile statistics as a first step toward addressing attacks on your community? I mean, the written testimony the coalition submitted on Wednesday presents a number of incidents on the first pages.
I think the Sikh American journey is just that. It's a Sikh @_American_journey. And part of that journey means gathering and putting forth your arguments before government and organizing and engaging in the type of advocacy necessary to be heard. And so this community really has begun organizing with a level of dedication and resources since 9/11. Unfortunately, it's taken 11 years for us to get pretty close to getting there, and I hope we'll get over the edge. But I really think we're very new to this country in terms of our organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working to get there, but we're just not there yet.
How could law enforcement do a better job in identifying dangerous potential domestic extremists before the next bloodbath?
Think Progress has a report out that says 80% of the terrorist attacks in this country since 9/11 have been committed by non-Muslim extremists. And so we've seen dozens of hearings in Congress on the threat of the Muslim community and al-Qaeda and its affiliates. This was the first on the threat of non-Muslim extremists here in the United States, and I think it needs to be the first of many. You're not going to start solving a problem unless you acknowledge it. That applies for the statistics issue with the Sikh community, but also applies with this larger issue we saw in Oak Creek of folks who have extreme ideologies using it to violently attack folks.
Wednesday's hearing was an important step. What other steps is the Sikh coalition taking?
One of the things that we're urging is for the president and the federal government to create an interagency task force specifically to address violent extremism and religious intolerance here in the United States. After the church arsons in the 90s, President Clinton created such a task force, mm-hmm. and it led to a precipitous drop in church arsons as a result of that task force. We'd like our federal government to do the same on this issue. Extremist groups, intolerant groups have risen, not declined over the last 10 years, and I think it's about time we create a presidential-level task force to address it.
What's your assessment of the hearing this past Wednesday?
The hearing is a step in the right direction. Issues that apply to the Sikh community, but in fact apply to all of us, the person who attacked that Gurdwara in Oak Creek hated Jews, he hated Muslims, he hated gays, he just hated a whole bunch of folks. That hearing is a first step. It's good that at least we've had a hearing in the Senate on this issue, but we've got to see more of this, more of everything, more engagement by the executive agencies, but also the legislative branch. But I'm happy with the start we had yesterday.
Media coverage of the Oak Creek massacre devoted a lot of time to emphasizing what some of us have known for a long time, and that is that many Americans mistake Sikhs for Muslims. Do you see that as even remotely relevant, and how do you navigate those waters?
An attack on one of us is an attack on all of us, and so you will never catch anyone in the Sikh community in our leadership saying anything to the effect that we're not Muslim. I think we very affirmatively have said we are Sikh, mm-hmm. We're proud of our tradition, and as you saw in Oak Creek, there was a lot of love that was being generated from the Sikh community, compassion rather than anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Harpreet Singh Saini said, you know, that man who killed my mother hated her. My mother was full of love. And I think when you have hateful, bigoted attackers, it's important, one, to not scapegoat. But second, it's also to demonstrate your values. And our values are values of love.
So much has been said about religious liberty during this endless election cycle. When you hear that term applied to debates about issues like health insurance mandates, how does that impact things like the religious liberty to wear religious garb or to worship without fear of being shot?
I think that those who advocate for religious liberty, it's critical that they advocate for not just religious liberty but everyone's liberty. Because your argument that I believe in religious liberty, it seriously gets undermined when the liberty that you're asking for infringes on the liberty of others. And so I would say that those who call for religious liberty, for example, with regard to health care,
mm-hmm.
Would call for religious liberty for all people and not infringe on anyone's liberty.
Mm. I want you to talk a little bit more so that our listeners will understand the Sikh Coalition and the work of the coalition.
Yeah. We are a baby of 9/11. We were formed on the night of 9/11. We are really out there to make sure that people have the right to be who they are. And so I really want to say that the Sikh Coalition's work impacts everyone. So, for example, in the school bullying context, we fought for a chancellor's regulation that protects everyone from school bullying. It was the first law of its kind for 1.1 million students in New York City. In California, just last month, Governor Jerry Brown signed it into law that expands religious workplace freedom for everyone, Sikhs, Muslims, Jews, and the like. And so we have initially been starting out as an organization to protect the rights of the Sikh community. But in fact, we're really fighting for everyone's rights. Yesterday's hearing was a good example when we were talking about violent extremism and how it affects everyone.
I do want listeners to be able to follow your work. Would you tell them how they can keep up with what the Sikh Coalition's doing, and if they want to get involved, where to go to check into that?
Absolutely. Our website is www.sikhcoalition.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @Sikh_coalition. And my personal Twitter handle is @Amar, A-M-A-R, Hoboken, where I'm from.
Amardeep, I have to say that you've been in my thoughts and prayers a lot. What has all this done to you?
I've gained a tremendous amount of inspiration from the resilience of the Oak Creek community. The last thing that the Sikh community prays for when we say our daily prayers is Chardi Kala for the whole world, which is a sense of buoyant optimism. Hmm. And so we pray for optimism as our last prayer, not for just us, for the whole world. And I think it's that spirit that is keeps me going. You should also know that the person who did what they did in Oak Creek is not America. He is not America. The people of America were literally the whole town of Oak Creek coming out at a vigil on that Tuesday after the attack, 2 days after the attack, and standing shoulder to shoulder together as Americans, as people of faith. That's America, and that's what gives me the inspiration to keep moving on.
Amardeep Singh, the co-founder and director of programs for the Sikh Coalition, it's always been a pleasure for the Interfaith Alliance to work with you, and I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
The feeling's the same. Thank you.
We've got to take a short break, but coming right up, Dr. Robert P. Jones, founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, he's just released a comprehensive new study on working-class American voters. The study is titled Beyond Guns and God, Understanding the Complexities of the White Working Class in America. You don't want to miss this one, I guarantee you. And later in the show, taking on Louisiana's school voucher scheme with Zach Copley. My name is Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. All week long, we've been subjected to furious debate about some controversial statements made by Mitt Romney at a fundraiser earlier this year. In a nutshell, the candidate seems to dismiss 47% of the electorate as permanently dependent on government services, paying no income taxes, and therefore beholden to Barack Obama. The president faced a controversy during his first run for the White House that seemed to write off some voters as being beyond reach. Whether or not either man really meant what he seemed to say, what's more important to understand is this: whether there are such massive, intractable blocks of constituents in this country. And one block that is often seen as such is carefully examined in the 2012 Race, Class, and Culture Survey, which highlights the vote values and worldview of the white working class in America, a group that doesn't get a whole lot of study. It's hot off the presses, and I'm very pleased to welcome its co-author and PRRI's founding CEO, Dr. Robert P. Jones, back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, welcome.
Thanks, Welton. I'm really glad to be here.
You write that both the right and the left accept certain stereotypes about this particular population. What would you describe that population and then shatter some stereotypes, if you will?
You know, I think that going into this survey, what we really thought was that there's not an absence of conversation or debate about white working class Americans, but there has been like an absence of good facts on the ground, right? And so, you know, this kind of old saying of like people are entitled to their opinions but not to their own facts, right? And what we've increasingly seen is that those on the right and the left actually seem to be throwing out their own facts about this group, and they both couldn't be true because they were both claiming opposite things. So we decided to get a little bit underneath, you know, some of the stereotypes, some of the conjecture, and really try to say, all right, what's real, what's not real, what's true, what's not true, which stereotypes hold up, and which ones really don't hold water.
How big is this group that we're talking about?
Yeah. So we might call this the 36%. The white working class represents one-third, a little bit more than a third, so 36% of the American population. It's a very large group. We're talking about people, sort of white, non-Hispanic Americans without a four-year college education and who have non-salaried jobs. That is, they get paid by the hour or by the job.
So did you find some characteristics held in common by the people in this group?
Yeah. Some of what is true is that this group lives in a little bit of a different geographical location than their white college educated peers do. So they're more likely, for example, to live in rural areas than they are to live in urban areas. When you look at the communities and you ask them what big problems are in their communities, two-thirds of the white working class say lack of jobs are a serious problem in our community, and a bare majority of white college-educated Americans say this. A majority of white working-class Americans say that a lack of opportunity for young people is a serious problem in our community, and less than a majority of white college-educated Americans say that. So they're geographically in different places, but also I think even within the same locales are living in communities that face very different problems.
If these voters are going to the polls in November to try to solve national problems as they see them.
Yeah.
What are the national problems? And are they interested in national problems or are they just interested in personal
problems? Well, I think it is the economy, right? I mean, this is not surprising. Right? This is a group that has been one of the hardest hit groups in the economy. Just one little thing about them, they are working more hours per average. So they're working on average 51 hours per week compared to only 46 hours per week of white college educated workers. Yet, even though they're working harder, they are far more likely to report that their financial situation is in fair or even poor condition, whereas a majority of white college educated people are say that they're actually in good or excellent shape. So they're working harder, doing less well. And they've been hit really hard with the economy. So they do say, like, in my local community, the biggest problem is a lack of good jobs and opportunities for younger people. But also, when you ask them what's the most important thing in their presidential vote, the national scene, by far the economy.
Will they vote?
Yeah. They are going to make up about 3 in 10 voters in the fall. And so that's a really important segment.
Robbie, I'm going to ask you about which presidential candidate these white working class voters are more likely to support in November. But I got to do that after we take a short break.
All right,
so
great.
We're coming back very quickly. I do want to remind everyone that there will be more of this conversation and all of the interviews on this week's show available online at stateofbelief.com. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. We'll be right back. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. My guest is Dr. Robert P. Jones, CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute, which has just released a comprehensive new survey titled Beyond Guns and God, Understanding the Complexities of the White Working Class in America. It's a terrific study that I hope you'll take a look at. Robbie, you've already said that this segment of the population is far more diverse in almost every measure than is commonly assumed. So, based on your research, who is the 2012 presidential candidate for the white working class?
Yeah. Well, overall, it's clear that Mitt Romney is doing fairly well in this group. So he leads overall among the white working class, 48%. To 35% compared to Obama. But in another way, you might want to ask, well, which segment of the white working class are you talking about? Because while he's doing well among white working class Americans in the South, those who are over the age of 65, those who are Protestant and men, he's winning handily among those groups. But among a bunch of other groups, he's actually in a dead heat with President Obama. So in among Catholics, among younger white working class Americans, among white working class Americans in the Northeast and the Midwest, and among women. It's actually a statistical dead heat between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. And that's likely to come as a surprise, I think, and breaks a little bit against the conventional wisdom that this is a Republican constituency that is just locked up.
Is there anything in your research that helps either validate or invalidate Romney's statement about the 47%? Because a percentage of the population you actually surveyed qualifies as the working poor, which is going to be reflected in whether they pay any income tax, and some members certainly receive government benefits.
Right. Well, one thing we know about, you know, the 47% that has now become quite famous is that 4 in 5 of them are in households with incomes of under $30,000 a year. Right. So that group, when we look inside the white working class, that group makes up about a third of the white working class Americans. And so it's a fairly big subset of this group. But we know that this group is, you know, they're working very hard. So like it kind of cuts against the image of, you know, people who are sitting around waiting on their government check. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about this group is that even though, for example, 1 in 5 of this group of white working class Americans has been the beneficiary of things like food stamps or unemployment benefits, those kinds of things. Even among this group, they still have concerns about government programs creating dependencies. So there's some real complexity here. So on the one hand, they might agree with Romney on the face of it, right? Mm-hmm. But their life experience is actually something quite different from that. So I think there's a real complexity here. But I think where they'll get off the train and maybe not so happy with the remarks is really anything that implies that one of the reasons why they're in trouble is because they've lost a strong work ethic, they've become lazy. That's just not the picture we see here as people who are looking for working very hard as they are, and also experiencing a pretty tough time in this economy.
When some leaders try to leverage religion to influence electoral politics, which, as you know, I think is always a bad idea, but we know it's happening. When they do that, I think they're picturing members of the white working class as being a large part of their audience. What did you find in this survey that either supports or debunks that notion?
Well, in terms of religiosity, I mean, this is all really quite interesting because on the one hand, on the left has sort of accused this class of being, you know, so enthralled with religion and traditional values that they vote against their own economic interests. Clearly, we don't see that here. In fact, one of the interesting findings that we have that a number of other studies have also confirmed is that it's actually white college-educated Americans that are more influenced by culture war politics than white working-class Americans. White working-class Americans are much more concerned with the economy than they are about this kind of, you know, I vote values, culture war politics that we hear so much about. And in fact, in any way you slice it, you look at what's the most critical issue to their vote, only 5% of white working class Americans say either abortion or same-sex marriage is the most important thing to their vote. It's just almost not on the radar screen at all among white working class Americans. And even if you look at their attitudes, I mean, they're fairly divided. So this is not a sort of, you know, anti-choice, anti-gay, strongly anti-gay marriage group. So while half of white working class Americans, for example, say that abortion should be legal mm-hmm. in all or most cases, and about 45% say it should be illegal, so very divided there. Mm. Half of them say are opposed to same-sex marriage, but 43% of them support it. Mm. So it's not really an overwhelming – it's really kind of division on these kind of culture war issues. So it's not really the constituency that really is going to be riding that bus, you know, to the polls in November.
Let's go – beyond what we've been talking about now for just a moment, and let me ask you about the Americans who fall into this category. What did you learn about them generally?
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think that, you know, I've said this already, but I'll say it again because I think it's really worth saying. These are hardworking Americans who are living in communities where they're really struggling. So they're the lack of jobs, lack of opportunities for young people are something that's very high on this group's list. And they're affected by that much more than white college-educated mm-hmm. Americans are. And some of that's about the kind of bifurcation that we find by class, even in very similar geographic locations. They're not animated by the culture war issues. The other thing that I think is really important is I think they feel very disconnected from government. You know, government has paid attention to minorities. Government is sort of taking care of the wealthy with tax breaks, and they're the group that's been sort of left on their own. Hmm. And I think that's something that I think both parties actually should, you know, kind of pay attention to, is that they really feel we had a question about how they think about government. And what we found is that white working class Americans are more likely to say when they think about government, they think about government as the government rather than our government. Oh. And that, I think, is a, sort of opens the door into a whole insight about just feeling like government's not responsive to them.
Robbie, what in this particular survey, I usually ask you this, what surprised you most?
Well, we haven't mentioned the Tea Party. I think this is one place, too, where, you know, early on, and we've done a lot of polling on the Tea Party, and, you know, early on, there still is this lingering set of assumptions that white working class Americans are the backbone of the Tea Party. We actually just don't find that, right? That they're no more likely than white college educated Americans to say they identify with the Tea Party. They're no more likely to say the Tea Party shares their values. It's just not a hardcore Tea Party constituency. I think the biggest thing that surprised me, though, is a big picture thing, and that is the complexity and the diversity of this group. For example, that the South – white working class Americans in the South look significantly different than white working class Americans everywhere else in the country. And so if you sort of take that to heart, it really does mean that we really ought to stop talking about this group as one group. They really are a very complex constituency.
Hmm. The 2012 Public Religion Research Institute Race, Class, and Culture Survey, which highlights the vote, values, and worldview of the white working class in America, is just out. Go to publicreligion.org. Take a look at it. Dr. Robert P. Jones is responsible for all of this. He's the founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and co-author of this study titled Beyond Guns and God, Understanding the Complexities of the White Working Class in America. Robbie, as always, thank you for taking time to be with us here on State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, always a privilege. Thanks.
Well, it's time for another quick break, and then I'll be joined by our friend Zach Coplin, a college sophomore and a tireless Louisiana education activist. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Regular listeners of this show will remember Zach Coplin, who first spoke to us, I guess it was when he was a high school senior, working to repeal creationism in the Louisiana public school classroom. We were very impressed at his tenacious coalition building in service to that cause. Zach is just returning to Rice University for his sophomore year. But he joins us now by phone from Houston. Zach, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. It's always great to be on the show.
Well, first, I want to say that the comprehensive way that you expose the various unaccountable schools, primarily religious schools, that are set to benefit from the Jindal voucher scheme in Louisiana on your website repealcreationism.com is nothing short of groundbreaking. If you would identify one or two of the most egregious situations that you found.
Thanks so much for that compliment. There's sort of been two things we've noticed. And the first is the much more popularized sort of, there was a Mother Jones article on it, mm-hmm. but there's several curriculums used by these schools. The Accelerated Christian Education, the ABECA curriculum, or the Bob Jones University Press curriculum. What these curriculums teach is, for example, that dinosaurs were real, lived with humans, and that dragons were even a type of dinosaur that lived with humans, or that the Loch Ness Monster is still around and disproves evolution. And also, there's a lot of problems with history and English. They've dismissed Mark Twain as not worth teaching. They've dismissed some part of math as not worth teaching. So there's wide problems with this curriculum. And then there's also other schools where we didn't find specific curriculum, but my favorite school, we discovered Claiborne Christian in West Monroe, Louisiana, puts out in their newsletter that from their principal that our position at Claiborne Christian on the age of the earth and other issues is that any theory that goes against God's word is an error. And then she goes on to claim that scientists are sinful men who are trying to explain the world without God, so they don't have to be morally accountable to him. Now, I know a lot of scientists, but most of them generally haven't struck me as sinful men. Most of them seem to care a lot about the world, and a lot of them are quite religious. So I really feel like this description doesn't fit and isn't what we should be spending public money to teach.
Yeah, and Zach, I've got to just underscore that because so many people think that when you and I talk about what's happening in Louisiana that we're over-exaggerating the situation. Folks, what Zach just described is education, which I think is indoctrination, done by federal funds, taxpayers' dollars. Now, Zach, how in the world has it come to this in Louisiana?
Governor Jindal is a Brown University biology major. There's no way he doesn't understand evolution, and that's true. Like, he is a Rhodes Scholar and a Brown University biology major. It would be an insult to Brown University and great professors like Ken Miller, who teach there, to say that their students don't actually understand the importance of evolution in biology. Mm-hmm. But so he signed this Louisiana Science Education Act, and we said he must not actually understand the implications. But now it's looking like there's a deliberate pattern of promoting creationism in Louisiana to pander to far-right groups like the Louisiana Family Forum. Right. And so we passed the creationism law in Louisiana. There have been massive fights over textbooks. Luckily, we've won those fights, and we actually have good science textbooks in Louisiana. And now comes along this voucher program. It's turned into a big issue of school choice and, like, teacher pay, mm-hmm. but this was passed under the cover of that. It's a program that is overwhelmingly filled with religious schools. It's hard to say how much because they've been hiding the numbers and only releasing what they're forced to. But they passed this program that we know is sending a lot of public money to schools like the 20 that are identified on my website that teach creationism and things like it. Some of them, there's even reports are teaching that the KKK was moral. I mean, that's an issue we all can get behind, is the KKK was in no way, shape, or form a moral group.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one of the things, Zach, that has just baffled me is how they have convinced parents in Louisiana that this is a good thing. What is, in your opinion, the central myth of the voucher plan's proponents that's helped give this so much popularity?
I think it's less of a central myth, and I think it's a very good job of distracting on the administration's part. They were passing an accountability measure for this voucher program. Mm-hmm. I attended that meeting and endorsed the accountability program. And when I endorsed it, I also said, here are 20 schools that I've documented that clearly don't meet the newly passed accountability standards. So I've asked for a date you're going to remove these schools from the program. Mm-hmm. And I also asked that they release the teaching materials of every other school so the public can see what these schools are teaching and which ones don't meet their standards. Now, I didn't receive a response there, and they haven't removed the schools. And when I managed to get Superintendent White, who's the Louisiana State Superintendent of Education, to answer a question for me on Twitter, but instead of answering why the schools aren't removed, he just told me to stop, basically he went with school choice.
Yeah.
And so they've done a very good job of strawmanning their opponents and arguing that any call for any accountability of this program would be harming school choice and would be attacking parents. So it's put anyone who asks for accountability on the defensive. There was one point where they got an email caught where they were discussing muddying the media narrative to confuse the reporters after there was reports of these like schools like this in the program.
Zach, we know how Jindal has pulled together people to support this folly. There's some people who just genuinely want to dismantle public education. There are others that saw it as a great opportunity to get money for their church schools.
Yeah.
How do we pull together equally motivated defenders of public education before it's too late?
The first way is we have to raise awareness. We have to just keep raising awareness, keep talking to people, keep people's attention on this, because people were outraged while there was media attention on this for months.
Mm-hmm.
But now, slowly, the Jindal administration has stonewalled. They've turtled up. They've refused to release any information that is actually meaningful, like how they actually chose the schools for the program. They've made the calculation that they can outlast all the attention on this, because it may be an issue in August, it may be an issue in July, but by January, everyone's forgotten. So that's what they're hoping to do. So we have to keep the focus on this. And then we just need to actually organize. We need to have people come out and go to the Capitol and protest this law. We need people to, in the spring, introduce repeal bills. We need people. Here's an interesting thing that I'd actually love to mention. So we've talked about the Louisiana Science Education Act.
Mm-hmm.
The Jindal administration is in violation of the Constitution right now with the schools and the program, because there's actually a constitutional provision that says the curriculum of any state-approved private school that's receiving any state funding must be equal to that of similar public schools.
Right.
Now, similar public schools, as you know, there's a loophole where they can teach creationism, but they're not actually supposed to per Edwards versus Aguilar.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jindal administration is in violation of the Constitution because the curriculum isn't equal with these schools, and they're keeping them in here.
Exactly.
And now what's ironic is their one defense they actually can claim is that they can use the Louisiana Science Education Act to defend their science curriculum and say, well, it's equal to public schools because we have this loophole here.
Hmm.
And I think they have to claim that because it's the only way they avoid a constitutional challenge on the basic fact that they're violating one of the provisions.
Yeah.
Having said that, that reveals exactly what the Louisiana Science Education Act does. It teaches it's for creationism.
Mm-hmm.
And also, ironically enough, this actually gives us an ability to challenge all the material in the private schools, because there is a provision in the Louisiana Science Education Act to challenge the schools in the program. So if they use the Louisiana Science Education Act as a defense, while it's impossible to actually successfully challenge the materials, because the way it works in this challenge is the person challenging appoints one judge, but the publisher of the materials and the teacher challenge appoint the other two. So it's automatically stacked against you. But the thing is, they have to hold a public hearing. So we can at least argue that they need to hold public hearings, and we can bring these materials to light and have hearings about them.
I want to remind you all that Zach Coplin's website address is repealcreationism.com. Let me encourage you to go there and to study it. Zach Coplin is an educational activist in Louisiana, just starting his second year at Rice University. He has done amazing amounts of research. He's giving us good advice on how to proceed. Zach, I thank you for what you're doing, and I thank you for sharing with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I just want to thank you, because I saw your letter you put out about the voucher program, and that was absolutely awesome.
Well, thanks, man. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com. To find out more about the show, hear these extended interviews, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. That way you can listen to us anytime, anywhere. We hope you share your thoughts on what you've heard on your social media accounts. Go to Facebook and Twitter. Contact us. It's available at stateofbelief.com. including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. And of course, as always, we encourage you to tell others about the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Please become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. We need your involvement. We need it. I hope you'll join us. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what? He was. Yes, he was.